listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
It's the new Football in Europe podcast, episode 16, with the latest news, talking points and strange stories from Germany, Spain, Italy, France and more. I'm Rob Daly, Chris Parrott's my co-host. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Well, shocks everywhere as the big boys drop points. For once, even Barcelona and Bayern didn't win. PSG did, though. Zlatan sets another new record. And we'll tell you about a German player who was forced to referee a girls' game by his club as a punishment.
I was in Germany seeing lots of football at the weekend, so headed to Schalke on Friday night to see their game against Hanover and see what all the fuss is about their young German international Leroy Sané.
He's only 19 years old and he's doing magic.
And he's from the area, so he's from around here. He's what, like one of us.
Yeah, he's fast and he's young.
Young and wild.
He's doing stuff other people don't do. I think in 2 or 3 years he is playing for Manchester City for a lot of money.
Staying with German football, Archie Rintat from BT Sport tells us about Gladbach's win over Bayern having been there. Plus we have part two of my chat with Jonathan Wilson of The Guardian and The Blizzard.
This is Football in Europe.
Thanks for downloading the latest edition of the show. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes as well. And your tweets have been coming in using FIE Podcast. Chris, last week, we speculated that Kurt Hurd and Liam Ross, who'd been in touch, were in fact together.
Yeah,
they were on their travels. They both tweeted in from matches in Prague.
In Prague, yeah.
And we said that'd be weird.
If they were both listening to the podcast in the Czech Republic.
But weren't mates.
Yeah, true.
And
yeah,
if not, maybe we could have united them.
Oh, yeah, they could have gone to see a game together.
But as it turns out, they are mates.
Okay.
As Kurt tweeted in, says, absolutely delighted to get a mention from the lads on the new podcast. Krakow and Excelsior in the last few days. And I can confirm that me and Liam Ross are indeed hanging out and on a trip together. Keep up the excellent work. Guys, if you are going to keep going to all these games, keep us updated.
Yeah,
they can almost be our Football in Europe correspondents or something.
Yeah, where are they next? How long are they away for?
Kurt, fill us in, mate. You can't leave us hanging like this. So keep your tweets coming in, FIE Podcast. Chris, let's talk a bit of La Liga before we get going into the rest of the show, because Gary Neville getting that appointment as head coach of Valencia was like the big talking point of the last few days.
Yeah.
Before we talk about whether we think it's actually a good move for him, he was in the stands, wasn't he, for Valencia's game against Barcelona. He didn't take charge.
No, he didn't take charge. Remember a week ago, we were speculating that Phil Neville would be in charge for the Barcelona game, and then he got usurped by his brother, which seems to happen on a few occasions.
I think he's quite happy about it.
He is. Yeah, exactly. But actually, he wasn't in charge either. And Valencia got a really good point at home to Barcelona, who have been brilliant, haven't they? Suarez scored for Barcelona. Arguably shouldn't have been on the pitch because he had a coming together with Abdenor when he seemed to stamp on him, in all honesty. And then typical Suarez, maybe gets away with something a bit naughty. Scored a goal, which he was probably offside. But
it was a great finish, though, wasn't it?
It was a great finish. Yeah. It seems to happen to Barcelona a lot, though. They seem to get a few favourable decisions. And then, but Valencia fought back and equalised late on. Really good draw for them, 1-1.
Yeah, a vital result for them. And Phil Neville couldn't actually be the official caretaker manager because he doesn't have the right coaching qualifications. So I think it'd be fair to say the reaction in Spain to Neville's Valencia appointment has been mixed. I mean, it generated a lot of excitement here because of Monday Night Football and Neville's profile in England. But, I mean, in Spain, surely he doesn't quite have the same currency.
No, I don't think he does. And I actually thought his press conference was good because he didn't shirk that. He said, yeah, I'm a no one in a coaching capacity. I've got to prove myself. The local press in Valencia, the local paper, was more favourable, as you'd imagine it would be here. The Madrid-based press was a little more sceptical in that he's got the job due to his relationship with Peter Lim. There's the whole super agent, George Mendes, who's involved. And a lot of Valencia fans have been unhappy how close he's been with the club. They couldn't appoint a Mendes character, if you like. So they went for someone like Gary Neville, who
he's a Peter Lim guy, or in a weird way, because of their Salford connection. They both are part of the ownership.
And there. I mean, but the thing is, it is an odd appointment. Imagine it was in England, and you're not talking about a Getafe or a Rayo Vallecano. You're talking about Valencia, so enormous name. Not quite Real Madrid or Barcelona.
With fussy fans as well, Valencia. Yeah,
with fussy fans, and they appoint a 40-year-old with no coaching experience, really, who can't speak the language. Imagine that happened in England. Imagine Tottenham appointed, I don't know, Michel Salgado. he would get ruined by the
British
media.
His English is actually excellent.
His English is,
haven't we both probably interviewed
him?
Yeah,
we have. Okay, so it's not Salgado. It's someone who can't even speak English. Can you imagine how the English press would react?
I think the problem that they will have if they don't get those results, and obviously they didn't put Neville in the dugout for the Barcelona game because who wants to start with what would likely have been a loss, but they did get a draw, is that the Valencia fans are concerned about what's happening upstairs and the way that's filtering down. And seeing them go for someone like Neville, given his connections already to the ownership, I think if things do start going badly, they won't give Neville much leeway.
I mean, it's only a 6-month deal? How many coaches get appointed on a 6-month deal anywhere?
Yeah, it's happening more, isn't it? It's like, we're going to try this guy.
Yeah.
It's almost, we're not quite sure. But then I suppose Neville's thinking he'll go to the European Championships with England.
And, I mean, certainly that's the British press's reaction, isn't it? It is essentially a 6-month audition for a job here, whether it's the national team or whether it's
Manchester United. I mean, some of the bookies are giving good odds on that.
And I mean, I hope he was a fat, brilliant pundit. He managed to turn himself from a fairly hateable player for football fans. You know, it was Gary Neville embodied Manchester United, who everyone didn't like because they won. Turn that public perception around immediately because he was so good. And I hope, as a British coach, he goes there and does fabulously.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually, that he did win. He did win everybody over. Elsewhere in Spain, Real Madrid beat Getafe 4-1 at the weekend. They did look pretty good, actually, didn't they, Chris? 4-0 up after 38 minutes. 2 for Benzema, 1 for Bale, 1 for Ronaldo. That's very 2014.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah,
they
it is.
The Champions League. So only 4 points off Barca after they dropped points and 2 points off Atleti. But Rafa Benitez has some other bigger things on his plate at the moment.
Yeah, thrown out of the Copa del Rey. Well, as things stand anyway. Amazing story. Denis Cheryshev was picked for the first leg of their tie away at Cadiz. He shouldn't have played because he should have been serving a ban due to his time at Villarreal. They then amazingly found that out during the game and hauled him off. But obviously you can't play a person who's supposed to be banned. So
the damage is, he scored as well, so the damage had been done.
The damage has been done. They've been kicked out. The Spanish newspaper Marca says that they're going to appeal and if necessary go to the top level of the legal, you know, system in Spain to try and overturn it. But the second leg is next week. So if they're going to do that, it's going to have to move pretty quickly. So you see, it's a right old mess. And amazingly, I was looking into it, it's not the first time it's happened in recent memory, which you think this is a once-in-a-generation thing. Osasuna were expelled last season. And also, when Benitez was in charge of Valencia, they were disqualified back in 2001 because they selected too many non-EU players.
Well, because I think Benitez, obviously, during the game, did you see this? At the Cadiz fans apparently were singing something like, check your Twitter, Rafa, because everyone was talking about it on Twitter that Cheryshev should not have been playing. But Real Madrid have said no one ever told us. But then there's people at the club, sort of match delegates, who should know this stuff.
Yeah. You're not supposed to be told it, Real Madrid. You're supposed to be in charge.
Next up, let's speak to Archie Rintat of BT Sport to start our Bundesliga roundup.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga roundup.
Archie, hello. Welcome to the show, mate.
Hi, Rob.
Let's talk about Jurgen Gladbach's 3-1 win over Bayern, which is amazing. How did they do that?
Well, a change of formation helped André Schubert, and it was an incredible result still. André Schubert, unbeaten, of course, in his tenure so far since taking over as interim coach originally at Borussia Mönchengladbach against Pep Guardiola, also unbeaten so far this season. But in the end, he turned out to be Pep's kryptonite, as the Bundesliga themselves actually put it. It was an amazing game in as much as Bayern had so much of the play in the first half. In fact, on 15 minutes, the floodlights came on. And as that happened, it seemed that the Bayern team got going because for the next 10 minutes, they absolutely pounded the Borussia Mönchengladbach goal. And to be honest, in past weeks, you would have expected them to go and score 3 or 4. But this time, the shots, they all came straight at Jan Sommer. I think that was almost just the moment when you knew that an upset could really be on the card. Sometimes when you see this odd shot hit the post, deflect wide, just hit the edge of the side netting and all that, you just kind of got this feeling that something special could happen. And that's what did happen in the second half.
So you spoke to Fabian Johnson, who's been in amazing form for Gladbach of late. You spoke to him after the game.
I did. But at half time, he was in the dressing room along with all the other players. And André Schubert asked the players whether they were comfortable with the formation they were playing. And if not, the implication was, do you want to change it? Which is not exactly the sort of thing that you can imagine Sir Alex Ferguson doing at Manchester United. It would be seen as bowing to player power. But I think it speaks of the rapport that André Schubert has with his players. And there is a very good reason that they are now 10 games unbeaten, because after half time, what happened was they absolutely blew Bayern away in a style very similar to actually the way that Real Madrid and Barcelona have done so in the Champions League in the past few years. That's how good they were when Oscar Wendt opened the scoring for them about 10 minutes after halftime. Lovely, intricate move that. And then there was a really, really crazy moment where Julian Korb, the Borussia Mönchengladbach right back, was through on goal and he hit it against Manuel Neuer and it deflected onto the crossbar, right? And there's that moment at 1-0 against Bayern Munich where the whole stadium knows that's usually your chance. And so every Gladbach player in the box kind of collapsed to their knees in disbelief, whilst every Gladbach fan, you just saw them clasp their hands to their face as if like, oh no, the chance is gone. But they went and then scored twice. Johnson, he's one of them. And he says he can't remember much from the celebration, but I remember vividly seeing him kick the corner flag off its hinges. So I think he was, fair to say, he was enjoying himself.
I like that celebration. I'm a fan of the destroy the corner flag, as if that ever did anything wrong to anyone.
From the Tim Cahill book of goal celebrations, I think.
It is. I mean, you went and spoke to a lot of people at Gladbach recently, didn't it? A TV feature for BT. I mean, the mood around that club, I mean, the stadium looked amazing at the weekend. The mood must just be amazing.
André Schubert, he's very calm. And I think the what's really worked for him, and especially the more that we see his side have success, the impression you get from the players is that he talks to the players and is really not emphasising the negatives too much. Lucien Favre was excellent at being able to pick out small details and helping the players improve on their game. But when you're not winning games and you're not able to pick the players' confidence up, there's not really much benefit in telling people everything they're doing wrong. That's not to say that he didn't do a good job. He did an absolutely incredible job to get them from 4 years ago. They were in the relegation playoff against Bochum, Marco Reus having to score the goal that actually kept them up in the end, and taking them back into the Champions League group stages, the main stage of the competition. The thing about Schubert is just the way that he's been able to take it on. Max Eberl has said, the sporting director, he usually has a plan for everything, but even he did not see this coming.
Let's just look at a couple of the other scores from the weekend. Hertha beat Leverkusen 2-1. That's really a battle for Champions League football between those clubs. And Shinji Kagawa scored a 93rd-minute winner at Wolfsburg. An amazing game there, because Wolfsburg had scored a late equaliser themselves from the penalty spot. A 2-1 win for Dortmund. So they're 5 points behind Bayern at the moment. But Archie, we met up in Cologne on Friday night and I was commentating on the Cologne game on Saturday. What have you made to this? So they played Augsburg, for people who didn't see, and they lost 1-0. And the visiting team goalkeeper Marvin Hitz of Augsburg, before a penalty was about to be taken, sort of kicks up the penalty spot, doesn't he? And Anthony Modeste goes to take the penalty and slips, and they go and lose the game. He misses the penalty. I mean, what's been the reaction in Germany to all this?
Hitz might get a retrospective ban because of his actions, i.e. scuffing up the ground and not playing in the sportsmanlike way that people may want to imagine. I think that, okay, if you want to take your moral high ground, yes, what Hitz did was bad. But to be honest, I do quite like seeing this kind of story. So you kind of have to kind of weigh that up. More sly, dirty tactics like this will create a more entertaining game. But also, just the fact that it extended Cologne's goal-scoring drought. They're now over 7 hours even without a goal at home. Actually, one of the cardinals from Cologne's cathedral, Cardinal Volki, went to the training ground this week to give the players all chocolate Santas to try and encourage them and help them through this goal drought. But not even a chocolate Santa can help Anthony Modeste, who's also now 7 hours without a goal.
Yeah, absolutely bizarre. I was also at Stuttgart Bremen at the weekend, which finished 1-1. Two teams down in the relegation zone. I'll talk about those teams more next week. On Friday night, headed to Schalke Hanover to see that game, speak to fans about Roberto Di Matteo's brief spell in charge last season. I wanted to get the thoughts of fans as well on their current head coach, André Breitenreiter. And I wanted to know why everyone's so excited about 19-year-old winger Leroy Sané. I headed to the game with ITV Bundesliga commentator Mark Scott.
So, Mark, we've just arrived at Gelsenkirchen Station.
Everyone's enjoying themselves. I will admit, there are about five or six shopping trolleys full of cans of beer.
Yeah, they have bottles of Veltin just in shopping trolleys. What's the policy?
I don't think it's a freebie, to be honest with you. I think we could try, but we might end up not getting in to see the game if we did give it a whirl. But there's like pretty crap music blaring out from behind us, but it's coming from a shopping centre, so that's amusing in itself. And the place is just stacked full of supporters.
Come on, fitness, get out!
Did the fans like Roberto Di Matteo or not?
No.
No.
Why?
I didn't like him because I think he just wasn't Schalke. He was, I don't know, when I saw him in his suit and his shiny shoes, I was like, ah.
What does being Schalke mean then if it's not that?
Passion? I don't know. Like,
in the end, he didn't give any results.
He had those players, but they weren't playing as a team. And right now, it's a team again. He brought them together. Again.
What do you think to Andre Breitenreiter?
He's a very good trainer. He's more for the fans. Yeah. He's young. He's pushing the young players. I think he's good.
Can I ask you about Leroy Sané? How good is Leroy Sané?
The best.
Why?
He's only 19 years old and he's doing magic.
And he's from the area. So he's from around here. He's one, like one of us.
Yeah, he's fast and he's young.
Young and wild.
He's doing stuff other people don't do. I think in 2 or 3 years he's playing for Manchester City for a lot of money.
I think it's always like that. The fans, they hope that that they will stay forever.
And Schalke went on to win the game 3-1. And there was an amazing choreo in the crowd before the game as well that's worth checking out on Twitter. Eintracht Frankfurt against Darmstadt, Archie. This was played on Sunday. So Darmstadt are back in the Bundesliga after a long time out of the top flight. So this is a derby.
A Hessen
and the fans
derby.
Have been waiting, and the fans have been waiting for this one for some time, it seemed.
Yes, a Hessen derby. And you could see this by the magnificent choreography that the Eintracht Frankfurt fans prepared behind the goal. However, they also did some things behind the goal which weren't so great. Darmstadt won by 1-0, which was very significant for Darmstadt. That's their first win over Eintracht Frankfurt in the Bundesliga in 36 years. Okay, Darmstadt have been out of the Bundesliga or so for 30 years or so. So a really big result for them, and also because it pushes them further up the table. Eintracht Frankfurt, however, there is a real bit of tension between their fans and the players at the moment, because the fans are not happy with the effort that the Eintracht Frankfurt players are putting in. They've only won one of their last 11 games in the Bundesliga. Armin Fee, he's returned to the club, the coach, this summer, and it's not working out. The perhaps the most frightening image of the day, and even of the weekend, actually, was the way that the Eintracht Frankfurt fans were burning Darmstadt banners behind the goal. To put it mildly, the Eintracht Frankfurt ultras are not renowned as being the friendliest kind of bunch of fans that you will meet in the Bundesliga. But I remember them tying up a knot of loads of away scarves and hanging them there to show that they'd managed to acquire them. I don't think they'd done it by asking for them friendly or buying them, let's put it that way.
Well, that's a little bit sinister, isn't it?
It is.
All right, so a great win for Darmstadt, regardless. And Archie, before we let you go, what's this story about a Fortuna Düsseldorf player having to referee a junior league girls' game as punishment for insulting a female referee? What happened there?
Yes, this is Kerem Demirbay. He is a second division player with Fortuna Düsseldorf, as you say, and he was sent off last weekend by Bibiana Steinhaus, who is very much seen as a rising star of refereeing in German football. She's not refereed a Bundesliga game yet, but I think it's seen as only a matter of time before she does so. And it is alleged that Kerem Demirbay said to her that women have no place in football. And as a result, the club made Kerem Demirbay go and referee this junior league girls game. It should be said that whilst that sounds like a nice gesture, there has been further controversy because Demirbay just dressed in casual clothes. He didn't dress like a referee. It didn't look like he was taking it entirely seriously. Yes, he smiled when he had the picture taken with all the girls after the game. But I think there's still a little bit of a sour taste left in the mouth there, especially after what he said and indeed how seriously he's taken his punishment. But It's nice, I think you would say, that Dusseldorf have tried to make a gesture, because I don't think there is any real room for that in football.
There's no room for it at all, Archie. And I'm glad you've said it as well. Mate, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I'll see you in a couple of weeks in Cologne, I think.
Will do. Thanks, Rob.
This is Football in Europe, Serie A Roundup.
Chris, we'll hear from Jonathan Wilson shortly, and we'll look ahead to the Champions League's final round of group games. Let's do some Serie A, and we'll do some transfer talk after that. So Napoli beat Inter in their Monday night game last week. That was played after we recorded the show, a meeting of the top two. But things didn't go to plan for Napoli this weekend. Beaten 3-2 by Bologna. What happened?
Roberto Donadoni, remember, has gone in at Bologna and been brilliant. I think he had his first loss last weekend, but they were 3-0 up after an hour. Awful mistake from Pepe Reina, who made a world-class save in that Inter game.
Yeah, I didn't see that. You were telling me about that.
Yeah, it was basically the last kick of the match, and he pulled off a brilliant save and then did one of those celebrations when he ran all the way out of his penalty area type thing. But he made a mistake for one of the goals. Gonzalo Higuain, who is absolutely banging form, got two goals back really late on, but Napoli couldn't rescue a point, so a 3-2 loss at Bologna for them.
Just keeps things more interesting, because Inter are top now. They've gone above them with a 1-0 win over Genoa. How many 1-0 wins is that now, Chris?
9 in Serie A this season.
So how many games? They've played like 15, 16 games or something like that.
Yeah, it's
staggering.
That is absolutely staggering.
Fiorentina second after they beat Udinese 3-0. I mean, I've had doubts about Fiorentina and the depth of their squad, but they're really hanging in that title race.
Yeah, they are starting to believe, according to Paolo Sosa, who's in his first year, remember, in Florence and doing a brilliant job, having won the title in Israel with Maccabi Tel Aviv, won the title in Switzerland with Basel. I know in this country, fans of Swansea and Leicester and QPR would think of Paolo Sosa and maybe chuckle to themselves, but he's in charge of a team well in the Serie A title race at the moment.
I've got a good Paolo Sosa anecdote to tell about when I interviewed him. I'll do it next week.
Okay.
Can you remind me to do that one?
Yeah.
Elsewhere, Roma drew 1-1 at Torino. They conceded a stupid late penalty. I mean, unbelievable. Yeah. But it was after the Roma supporters had delivered these crates of carrots to the club's training ground, blocking the entrance. Roma fans unhappy. They also had a banner up in Italian that said, "Eat well, rabbits." It's an insult that rabbits are cowardly or something in Italy, and it's all to do with their performances recently, and especially when they got destroyed by Barcelona at the Nou Camp. Tell me about this quick red card in the Atalanta 3-0 win over Palermo, Chris.
Oh, one of the most amusing things this weekend. For Atalanta, they won 3-0, but Giulio Migliaccio came on against his former team, Palermo. He left there a couple of years ago. 32 seconds later, terrible high foot. Started.
Wow, that's even quicker than Steven Gerrard against Man United,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's very
season?
Quick. And off. Straight red card.
What did he do?
Well, it was like one of those high foots, and he studded someone in the back. It was a terrible challenge, and you just...
Not good.
You feel so silly walking off the pitch, wouldn't you? Having walked on there less than a minute before.
So Lazio lost as well. That's 5 defeats in 6.
Yeah, massive pressure. They lost to Juventus, who have now won 5 in a row. Dybala scored. Gentiletti got an own goal.
That Dybala goal was tasty, wasn't it? A couple of flick-ups on the edge of the box and then volleyed
in. And then volleyed in, yeah. And it's all... I mean, basically, Pioli looks like he's on his way. Marcelo Lippi has been linked with the club for a number of weeks now, and he was spotted the stands.
Right.
He was sitting close to the Lazio owner. It seems a matter of time, according to reports in Italy. And Stefano Pioli, who did that amazing job last year, got Lazio into the Champions League. They didn't qualify. They got knocked out in the playoff round to Leverkusen. And then this year, really, it just hasn't gone right. It looks like his days are numbered. And we just talked about the pressure for Rudy Garcia at Roma, but the two Rome clubs are not having the best of time at the moment.
So tell me about one of their players as well, Senad Lulic. I saw this story about him losing a finger or a part of a finger in a freak training ground accident.
It's one of those which there's a few reports, because Lazio haven't come out and said exactly what happened, but he seemed to lose the top of his fourth finger in some sort of accident in the gym. I know. So there's no return date. He had reconstructive surgery. They've announced that.
God.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see what happened to that. But it makes you feel a bit queasy.
It does make you feel a bit queasy, yeah.
Chris, we normally try and keep it highbrow, but as the January transfer window is coming up, do you want a bit of silly season transfer rumours?
Yeah, we're only a month away from this, aren't we?
Yeah, so I'll give you three and you tell me if you think they're goers or not.
Okay.
Chelsea and Antoine Griezmann in the January transfer window, £22 million. £22 million, that was in the mirror.
No.
Didn't Atletico pay that for him?
He's got a buyout clause of 80 million euro, I think. So if Chelsea want Griezmann, he's going to be one of France's stars at Euro. He'll have to be. They will not get him for 22 million
pounds. I don't think they'll get him in January anyway. Lequipe, Edison Cavani to Manchester United, 32 million pounds. I think they're talking about that maybe being next summer anyway, but...
Well, Manchester United are going to sign a striker, presumably. Whether they do it in January or not. Would Cavani be a possible? Yeah, I think he would. So would Higuain. There's all this speculation about Zlatan's future, though. And until that gets resolved, I can't see them parting ways with Cavani
exactly.
in January.
We'll talk about Ibra later on, about his future. But I think if Ibra is going to leave at the end of the season, why sell their other guy who could play centre forward?
And also in January as well.
Yeah.
It's just, why would you, if you're a big club like Paris Saint-Germain with all that financial power, why would you sell one of your best strikers?
Arsenal have been linked with Lucas Moura of Paris Saint-Germain. £30 million to the Brazilian, which I think is roughly what they paid for him in the first place. I mean, he's not first choice, is he?
Yeah, which means that maybe you could get him, unlike Cavani, who is a massive part of PSG's team. Maybe. I mean, he
but
was
another
linked...
attacking midfielder.
Exactly. I mean, he was linked with Manchester United's when he went to PSG, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And they didn't get him. So, maybe, I mean, if they're going to spend 30 million, Arsenal, buy a defensive midfielder. Please.
So we're not having any of these this
no,
week?
No, not having any
of those.
A
load of nonsense. Okay, time for part two of my chat with Jonathan Wilson, the Guardian football writer and author of the books Inverting the Pyramid and Behind the Curtain. Last week, you would have heard us discussing Eastern Europe. This week, we talk football in Argentina and his magazine, The Blizzard.
This is Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Do you have a favourite place to go watch football, a favourite city, favourite country even?
Yeah, in terms of the city, I was at the Euro playoffs. I went to three of them. And I sort of was reminded by how much I like Slovenia. I was in Ljubljana and went up to Maribor for the game. And Ljubljana is just a very, very beautiful, very relaxed city where very easy to eat well. So that's in terms of just liking the city. Sarajevo, I think, is a great place as well. Budapest, so, the three I went to are all cities I really like. I guess that sort of like central European feel, that kind of architecture, that kind of food appeals to me for whatever reason. But in terms of atmosphere on the ground, I think you're probably looking to Argentina. I mean, there can be a real unpleasant edge. But I think the crowds they still get in Argentina, I think it's still the 9th or 10th best supported league in the world. You go to somewhere like Racing, where it's a huge bowl, that stadium. It's not full, but it doesn't feel empty. They still get 45,000 on a regular basis, and they still have sort of 10,000 who are making huge amounts of noise that's completely disproportionate to the quality of the football, which is unfortunately pretty awful. places like Racing, River Plate, Boca. The sense of, I guess, this links into the Central Europe thing. That sense of faded grandeur is something that appeals to me. So you go to El Monumental and it's hardly changed since 1978. So you can kind of, all the pictures you saw of the final in 78, it's very easy to sort of conjure up the memories of the videos you've seen of that game. And I imagine that's a real pain in the arse. If you're going there regularly and having to work there regularly, that you want somewhere like the Emirates. It's nice and comfortable and easy and has great food and the Wi-Fi works and everything. But in terms of just sort of a historical experience of this sense of stepping somewhere that was very, very important in the past, I think Argentina, Buenos Aires, and then Buenos Aires as well, there's so many stadiums in the city. You don't have to think. You just go and get a hotel in Buenos Aires and there'll be two games that weekend you can go to, at least two games that weekend you can go to. I love Ljubljana and Sarajevo as cities as well.
I went to Buenos Aires last year and bounced around matches. I didn't know that away fans didn't go to like the River Plate games and stuff like that. So we got snuck into the River Plate game by a guide. Where you pay a guide and they pay off the guys on the security checks. And then at the end, the fans started fighting with each other, the River Plate fans. I was amazed by that. Like it was organised crime or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, essentially you had what you might call normal hooligans, sort of normal ultras, who sort of drifted away from the game, partly because the football got worse and worse, partly because there was no money in it, and part of their whole reason for being there was to sort of extort money. And what happened then was that newcomers came in And then you had the Football Para Todos program that the Kirchner government invested in, I don't know, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that, where essentially the government bought out the TV contract and paid significantly more than the existing TV contract, which essentially, I mean, they deny it, but essentially the government is subsidising football because it recognises that if you have huge amounts of football on TV at the weekend, people watch that and they don't sort of get politically engaged and it, you know, calms everybody down. So, you know, classic sort of bread and circuses. Yeah, it's a very, very old-fashioned form of government. But, yeah, this new influx of cash, that I think it was about 5 times what the previous TV deal had been, suddenly there is money in the clubs again. And so the old barracks, the old ultras, come back in and they find that new ones have risen. So you have these factions even within clubs. And that's one of the huge problems they've got because, you know, in England, when we had our hooligan problem, it was relatively easy to segregate off away fans. You could tell who supported whom. If you have two factions of the same club fighting each other, segregation does nothing. So banning away fans, I guess, makes it easier to police and that it's one less thing to worry about. But it's still pretty difficult and, you know, some games can be pretty dangerous.
And can I ask you one on the Blizzard as well? I mean, how fun has it been to produce your own magazine and have that work out really well?
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's we've been going, 5 years now, something like that. I mean, it's great being in control. It's great being able to, you know, decide what goes in and what doesn't. And it's great not being constrained by worrying about, is this going to be popular? You know, what do advertisers think? I mean, that's one of the reasons we don't make much money. I don't make any money. And the model seems to work. You know, people, the pay what you want model, you know, people have been pretty reasonable in terms of paying a fair amount. And equally, the profit share, you know, I didn't know if writers would go for that. You know, I think it's understandable that writers want to be told you'll be paid this much money. And the way we do it is we say, well, you get this proportion of whatever profit we make at the end of the year. We're making enough profit that it's a reasonable amount of money we can give away. But writers seem to be pretty understanding about how that works, and there is a nice sense this is a collective project, that it's not just about a company going out trying to exploit the market. It's about saying to a relatively small niche of people, this is the kind of writing we like doing, this is the kind of writing you like reading, let's work together and try and make this viable.
This is Football in Europe.
So a big thanks to Jonathan Wilson for joining us on the podcast of late. Chris, let's talk French football. Zlatan Ibrahimovic is a major talking point in France.
As always.
Yeah, I mean, what's the situation with, because his contract expires at the end of the season. We've sort of alluded to this.
Yeah, well, so first of all, he's now PSG's record goal scorer. Scored 2 against Nice. Record goal scorer in Ligue 1, I should say.
Right.
So yet another record he's got with the Parisians. But yeah, his contract's up in the summer. Laurent Blanc, before the game, said he doesn't know what's happening. Zlatan said, only I'm going to decide. If you believe the reports, that might not be true. I think he'd like to stay, but it's whether the owners are going to give him another bumper new deal. He's 34. Is he still that? Is he still the right person to be paying all that money to League?
So would he take like a year contract? I don't know.
Maybe, but also it according to reports anyway, depending on whether they get Cristiano Ronaldo. And that seems a genuine possibility as opposed to just
Silly rumour.
And if they get Ronaldo, would that budget go on him? And then Zlatan wouldn't be the main man at all. So he would go somewhere else. Where would he go? He says he still wants to play. And of course, he's going to Euro after starring in that playoff for Sweden against Denmark. So up in the air, I think, until that Ronaldo decides where he's going to play next year.
It's
all potentially interlinked.
PSG got a 3-0 win against Nice. Ibra scored twice.
Yeah, scored twice.
And Cavani got the other. But Chris, I mean, Lyon taking on Angers, who've been like the surprise story in France at the Stade de Gerland. Tell us the story of this, because there's a lot of talking points out of the game.
Well, it's the last league game ever at the Stade de Gerland. They're moving to a brand new home ahead of Euro 2016. I think it opens very early January. So they had all their former stars like Sylvain Wiltord,
Juninho,
Sidney Govou there, all applauding the fans, and they applauded them before the match. They promptly went and lost 2-0. They're in an awful run of form. Looks like they're going to change manager. And then at the end, they had fireworks. all this after they'd been booed off.
What celebration was it then for the end of the era there?
Celebration for the end of the stadium. They actually have a League Cup game next week, which will be the final ever match there. But it was sort of a damp squib because you had all this celebration of the Stade de Gerland, and then on the pitch, Lyon were beaten by Angers, newly promoted, sit second. Amazing story.
Where and Lyon should be.
Where Lyon should be. And, you know, a genuine chance at the moment of them, Angers, playing Champions League football.
You used the expression damp squib there. Someone, I was speaking to someone recently, and they thought the expression was damp squid. the squids are always damp, which they... Well, they
sort of works.
Sort of does work. Chris, winter break in Switzerland and Russia. So where are we with those two leagues as things stand?
So let's start with Switzerland because the title already looks wrapped up. Basel are top by 10 points from Grasshopper. I mean, that's, you know, after only 18 games to be 10 points clear is amazing. Russia is very interesting, actually, because Zenit have been absolutely amazing in the Champions League. They've won 5 games out of 5. Well, they're fifth. They're not even in the European places going into the break. CSKA are top, 37 points, 3 points clear of Rostov. And then Lokomotiv Moscow and Spartak are third and fourth. So it's anybody's title.
Yeah, Rostov doing really well this season. Okay, Chris, I think it's time to talk Champions League football.
Huge week, isn't it?
Yeah, so let's just go through, because it all gets a little bit complicated, and we'll focus on the English teams here. So in Group A, Real Madrid have already won that group. Paris Saint-Germain will finish second. Paris Saint-Germain play Shakhtar, Real Madrid, Malmo. In Group C, Benfica and Atletico are already through. They play each other to see who wins the group. And City and Juve are through, although City face Gladbach. The problem for City is that Juve are ahead of them, and City, as things stand, are likely to finish second. Not good for the Champions League draw, with Juve going to Sevilla. Although I'm not quite sure. What do you reckon will happen there? Do you reckon Juve will win that group?
Yeah, because if they get a point, they, you know, City have to win and Juve have to lose in order for City to finish
first.
Right,
okay.
So, they you know, they have that tightrope of maybe facing a Barca or a Bayern in the last 16.
So I suppose what will be encouraging for Man United in Group B is that Wolfsburg did lose at home at the weekend to Dortmund. And Manchester United go there. Do you think realistically they need a win? I mean, what's the scenario here?
Yeah, probably. You know, they go through and win the group with a victory. And although it's going to be difficult, Wolfsburg go through with a draw. So how do they play that? It's an interesting one for United. I think they're well capable of going there and winning Manchester United. I think a lot of the issues they've had in England is that everybody just sets up defensively against them.
And they set up defensively against everyone else.
Oh, they do, but Leicester last week attacked them, and actually it was a really good game. And the problem is, when everyone goes to Old Trafford at the moment, they, you know, it's 10 men behind the ball, and teams are frustrating Manchester United.
So I don't think United will win there. If they don't, so give me the scenario. So say United draw or lose. How does it affect with the other game?
If they draw or lose, it's out of their hands. They have to win.
Because if PSV beat CSKA Moscow, then it's done.
Yeah. Or I should say, they have to win. The only way they can guarantee going through is if Manchester United.
That's what we want. Group E, Barcelona are through, but all of Roma, Leverkusen and Barthe have a chance to finish second. But if Roma beat Barthe, they qualify. But you wouldn't back them to do it based on their current form. Zenit have won Group H. Gens will join them from Belgium with a win. Or if Genev's Valencia do not win.
Yeah.
So what a huge game for Neville.
Oh, it's a massive first game. Huge, huge first game. You know, they left him off the bench against Barcelona because they didn't, you know, it was a difficult game. Don't want to get off to a losing start. Well, this is an equally huge game. Lyon are pretty woeful at the moment. So you would expect Valencia to win, but Gent are ahead of them. So if Gent beat Zenit, who are heading into their winter break and are already through...
As winners, I mean, they've literally
winners,
played for nothing.
Then Gent, in their first ever season in the Champions League, would go through, and that would be quite the story. So, yeah, it's an enormous first game for Neville.
Chris, can Arsenal, they need to win by 2 goals or by a high-scoring 1-goal margin away at Olympiacos. 3-2 would be enough for them to qualify for the next round. Do you see them doing that?
I think they'll come close. I think, as I said last week, it'll be a classic Arsenal falling just short. How they've got themselves into this position.
Nah, it's insane.
You know, losing to Olympiakos at home is what everyone
talks
about.
That's the one Arsenal fans are more upset about.
Yeah,
than
I would say losing away to Dinamo Zagreb. That's close to being unforgivable. So because of the 3-2, they basically have to win by two goals or a 3-2 win. So if they win, basically if they win any other scoreline apart from 1-0 or 2-1, Arsenal will go through. But this is an Olympiakos team who won at the weekend, 13 wins out of 13 domestically to start the season. And in Piraeus, they're very good in the Champions League.
I suppose for Chelsea, as they take on Porto, the thing that matters for them to qualify is a draw's enough.
A draw's enough.
But they lost to Bournemouth at the weekend, so you wouldn't back on them necessarily getting that.
If they had to beat Porto, I would be sceptical of their chances. Right. But the fact they can go through with a draw, I think, is... they probably will have enough. It's an amazing group, that, because what might happen is if that's a draw and Dinamo Kiev win, which you can see, they'd all finish on the same amount of points. And
then it goes down to goal difference between the teams.
Yeah, and that is
on level on
points. Is incredibly tight as well. So the three teams would be split and Dinamo would finish first, Chelsea would finish second, Porto would finish third.
And then Porto miss out, having beat Chelsea
exactly
at the Dragao. Don't forget to keep your tweets coming to us using FIE Podcast and follow the Audioboom account as well. Chris, we're back next Monday.
We are back next Monday.
And we're going to talk about the MLS, are we? Because that finished last night with Portland Timbers being champions.
Exactly.
But we're going to talk about what we're going to talk about with that.
The European players and the strength of the MLS now the season is over.
And don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. That's it from Football in Europe.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.